Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. Award-winning playwright Dominique Morisseau is a Detroit native whose work often brings the voices and spirit of the city to the stage. She was just named a recipient of the 2018 MacArthur Fellowship, also known as the Genius Grant. Morisseau has worked as a producer and story editor for the Showtime series Shameless. She also worked with Penn State graduate theater students to create Blood at the Root, a play inspired by the controversial Gina Six case. The award-winning play toured nationally and internationally. She joins us on Skype. Dominique, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First, congratulations on your MacArthur Fellowship.
Thank you.
You've had some time to process it now. How are you feeling about the honor?
Oh, I'm still processing. It's an amazing honor. It's one of the highest honors that I can get in my career. And so it's profound to be here in this moment when I feel like I still have so much work to do. But it's also just an encouragement for me to continue to do the kind of work that I want to do and now have more resources to be able to do it.
And speaking of those resources, the fellowship comes with a $625,000 prize that you can use however you want to. Do you know yet how you plan to use it?
You know, it's so funny. I always want to correct people since they do put your money out there like that. That is over the course of 5 years.
Yes.
It's broken down into like $125,000 a year. But I do in a general sense. You know, I have a lot of initiatives and projects that I'm working on in my hometown of Detroit. You know, I support theater initiatives there and student arts programs. And so those kind of initiatives are things I'm trying to branch out and do further in my city.
And, you know, sometimes I think artists' creativity comes from a lack of resources. You know, if you're broke and you're trying to put on a play or create a movie, you have to get very creative to do that.
Absolutely.
And this sort of frees you up from that. So is it, you know, a different process, you think, for what you're thinking about using it, or just these kind of different initiatives like you just mentioned?
I think, you know, I mean, it's part for me to be able to branch out and do and expand my vision as an artist. But there's also something to be said, you know, yes, I have been the starving artist like a lot in my life. You know, I'm really, you know, I'm in a middle-aged part of my life now. And that is this is the first time in my life where I'm independently for the past like 5 or 6 years been able to be an artist without being anything else, you know, without having to have a different kind of job or a save my life job, a day job. And what happened the first moment that I ever was able to live a whole year as a playwright, just being a writer with another kind of award that I had won, it allowed me, I wrote like several plays that year that have now, some of them are the most produced plays in the country this year. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it allowed me to produce work. And so even though I know diamonds are made under pressure, they also can be really refined, you know, with care and time and a lot of support, I think. And so you don't have to necessarily always create art out of stress. You can be able to plan better and I think not make your art be temporary, but be institutionalized and become a part of like our fabric of our society. And that's what I want to do with my work.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that because I think also when this will allow people, even more people, to know your name. And I think there's a tendency for people to think, oh, she's a newcomer or, you know, who's this new person on the scene? When really there must have been a grind for a number of years.
And when I say a number of years, I mean, I moved to New York in 2001, right after 9/11. And I lived there from 2001 till 2015 without breaking the, you know, without being bi-coastal or anything. And then in 2015, I started being bi-coastal between New York and L.A. So from 2001 till about 2010, that's when I got in an emerging writers group that sort of, I think, launched my visibility to the off-Broadway theater community in a different way. But from 2001 to 2010, that I wasn't, you know, invisible. I just wasn't on their radar. I was building with my peers. I was, you know, doing my own creative collaborations with people. You know, and some of those people that I was building with back in the day are now powerful leaders of their own institutions right now in theater and in the world. You know, they started their own programs. that one of my friends, she's now the executive artistic producer at the Apollo Theater, you know? And so this journey, these are people that I've known back in the day when we were just kind of being artists trying to find our way. So that time that it takes to build your brand as an artist, I think people think once you get known, when they found out about who you are is when you began, but my story begins long before you've ever heard of me.
You're quoted in an LA Times article from a few years ago as saying, "My liberation as a writer is when I'm not writing under a white gaze, but I'm also not writing under a black gaze. I'm actually writing under my gaze." What did you mean by that? And do you feel like you've been able to do that?
That's a great question, because it's such a focus of where I am right now in my work. I think what it means to be writing under a white gaze is to be always concerned with how white audiences will or will not find their way into your work, but also how white critics and white institution leaders and just anyone in positions of power and authority, how they will engage with the work, how they will understand the work and be able to base the value of the work on their cultural aesthetic. I think what a black gaze often can do is put you in conversation with the white gaze as well, which means that I think oftentimes a black gaze is wanting there to be a certain kind of agenda for the story that serves, I think, a particular viewpoint of the black community. I think it might be, sometimes I find that damaging, because I also say policing black artists means trying to tell them how to tell the stories of their communities. But to focus on that kind of limitation stops them from telling their own truths as black artists and being their truths and their skin. And so for me, my liberation is not having to worry about how my work will be related to or understood by white audiences, but it will also be not having to have black audiences be concerned about what my work is saying to white audiences. Right. Rather, yeah. I'm just able to tell my truth and speak for the people that I want to speak for without having to worry about how everyone else is going to worry about it.
And are you at the place where you feel ready to do that, or have you been doing that?
I do. I think it is not only freeing as an artist, but it is true liberation as a person, I think, to be able to take up space in this world without asking for other people's permission to do so. And I think it's dangerous to feel that we're here by the graces of other people's opinions, as opposed to by the graces of our own ingenuity. I think it's liberating as a human being to say that my humanity is not transactional, and it is not something that can be, I think, bartered or traded or put in a good place, be told to behave well, and that is where my value of humanity comes from. My humanity is valuable just because. And that, I think that way about everyone else, you know. It's this sort of I liken it to when we talk about, you know, young black men that have been killed by police. You know, we're always trying to put behavior on their human validity. You know, well, were they good? Were they nice? And none of that should devalue their humanity.
Your work in general is very musical, but you just wrote what I believe is your first musical, Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations. How was that writing process different than writing one of your plays?
What I'm excited about with this particular musical is because my work is already musical. I do love to write to music. I'm married to a music artist. My husband's a hip hop artist. And so between the two of us, music sort of rules our lives. It rules my art. To be able to write to a musical is to let the song and the lyrics be a co-writer with me in the play. You know, so the lyrics actually do half of the dialogue work. And so then I'm just helping to fill in and shape and allow the lyrics to take on the story that I'm navigating. And so it's a special experience to do that for something like the Temptations music, because I get to add a lot of extra value and meaning to their work contemporarily. You know, something that back in the day might have just been a song between a man and a woman, now in 2018, that might become a song about, you know, a man speaking to his brothers or to a group of men speaking to their nation. Mm-hmm. And it just gets to get, you know, deeper and more complex, I think.
So Detroit is near and dear to your heart. How do you think the Detroit that you've set out to portray in your plays, particularly your three play cycle, The Detroit Project, how do they show a different Detroit than we typically see or hear about?
Well, we go back to humanity. I think when people have been talking about Detroit, what made me want to do the cycle in the first place, the cycle of plays, is that I just felt like Detroit was getting a very limited story told about it in the media. It was bad narration is what I call it. You know, it was a lacking understanding of the people, lacking understanding of how the city's politics work, and lacking a basic understanding of just what Detroiters are truly about and what makes them thrive and what's their driving force, which I think is in many great ways love. It's a very loving city. People call it a tough city. It is, you know, but it's a tough city in that it asks a lot of you. It asks for you to be resilient and to be hardworking. And that's not the story that you hear about us in a popularly, but you also don't hear the story about, you know, just the caring, tender, loving parts of the city and the people that will stop for you on the side of the road, or the people, you know, when your car breaks down and not just drive past you, or the people that will, you know, let you into their home and cook you a meal with their, you know, minimal scraps of food sometimes, or their abundant, you know, food. It's the innovators in the city that, you know, have vision and are changing the landscape of our nation in their artistic endeavors. Like, we just don't have that kind of story told about us often. So my work, to me, is telling the story of the Detroiters that I know. I know their hearts, and I know what makes them move, and they are part of the people that build this country, literally, in the auto industry, and I celebrate their full and total humanity.
And that three-play cycle that includes Detroit 67, Paradise Blue, and Skeleton Crew, you've talked about being inspired by August Wilson's 10-play cycle about Pittsburgh. What is it about August Wilson's work that resonates with you?
Well, he captures the jazz and the blues of his people, I thought. And there's just something, the rhythmic, musical way that he hears his community. I thought, yeah, that's right. Like, you know, I think that there's I call it the poetry in our everydayness. You know, I mean, especially, you know, Black elders from the South, they have all these really interesting, like, ways of saying things that are just everyday poetry, but they don't probably hear themselves as poetic when they say it, you know. Mm-hmm. But things like, you know, yeah, you put your foot in it. I mean, that's like, that's a metaphor, you know what I mean? To say that you slam dunk, or you threw down on something, you know. But it's those kind of things where here's one that I didn't know of until my husband taught it to me from his family, and then I put it in Skeleton Crew, which was a, you know, if you're feeling froggy, go on and leap. Like, that is a hell of a metaphor. That's a hell of a, like, idiom, you know, and there's 100 of these. It's exciting to celebrate what our poetry is, and that's what August Wilson did for the people of Pittsburgh. And I thought, okay, I want to do that for the people of Detroit, these folks that I know that are our elders that come from the South, that migrated to the North looking for jobs, you know, and started to redefine, like, a language in our Midwest. And that's exciting to me.
You are an outspoken, I would say, advocate for diversity in all parts of the theater, from leadership positions to actors. Why do you think that's important?
Just like leadership in a nation is important, you know, who gets to be at the head is who gets to make decisions for the body. And when you have heads that don't reflect the body or the interests of the body, you know, we have a huge disconnect and we have chaos as a result. And so I think that's the same thing within a theater industry. You know, when the head does not, when all of the heads do not reflect any, the wide range of the body, there's going to be some malfunctioning going on in that body. And to me, I think that there needs to be a holistic approach to changing our nation. And I think theater is a big part of changing our nation. It gives us, you know, image and story to help us be able to process ourselves. So it's really important that if theater is going to be the vanguard of change in the nation, it has to model that change infrastructurally.
And you said in your MacArthur Foundation video that you wanted to see the kind of people that you write about in the audience along with the kind of people that you don't write about. First of all, how would you describe the people that you write about?
Well, I write about the working class. I write about you know, people, poor people. You know, I don't always write about poor people. I also write about middle class, you know, folks. I write about the juxtaposition of poverty and middle class. You know, I write about industrial folks. I write about Black African-American communities and culture. I write about the education system. To me, any of those kind of people that should be in my shows. You know, and those kind of audience members should be in my shows, you know. I've written about Latinx and, you know, white working class people. They should be in my shows as well. They should be in my audiences. But it would be senseless to have a show that is about them and they are absent from the audience. And that's been my concern, or largely absent, you know. So when I look at my musical right now and I say, wow, you know, this is a cast, you know, a very predominantly African-American cast, you know, and we have one white amazing performer in our show, but it's a predominantly African-American cast. So if our audience looks nothing like the people on the stage, then that starts to feel very much like a time in the past that I don't think we want to repeat. It would be, you know, we come from a tradition of Black performers not even being allowed to patron the places that they're performing in. And we don't want to feel like we are in some kind of Jim Crow situation where the performer's coming through the back door entertaining white audiences, but they're not equal to them. So that can be changed by changing the demographics of that audience, letting white audiences, Black audiences, Latinx audiences, Native American audiences, Asian American audiences, because these are all audiences that are in the theater, but they're never integrated. And I think that to truly, you know, show a shift in the nation, we have to be able to do that inside of our theater houses.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note from WPSU. I'm Shireen Stanford. My guest is Dominique Morisseau, a playwright, performer, and recipient of the 2018 MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. She joins us on Skype. As an earring aficionado myself, I have noticed that you have a signature style of large hoop earrings that I've seen in lots of pictures. And certainly when we've talked in person, is there something about those earrings that are a reason why they're a part of your style?
Since I was in high school, I have just loved big hoops. I've never really, you know, people actually asked me about I guess they just look like they have such meaning because I've adopted them for so long. and you know, I think sometimes, I think of LL Cool J with a round the way girl, and there were all these symbols of like bamboo earrings and these two pair. That's the symbol for like an around the way girl. And to me, so are big hoops. That's my symbol for like, I am like a girl from a city, from like, you know, I'm from around the block, and that's my signature around that. I also think I just really like circular. I'm into circles, you know. I think circles represent like infinite possibility, you know. Like circles are just that we're connected. There's some sense of connectedness that with the circular shape that I like, you know. But I think more about they just represent being really down, and I know I love them for that.
I'm wearing hoops right now.
Yes, all the down girls.
So you've also written for television shows like Shameless, and you have a musical and several plays under your belt. Is there a particular style of writing that feels more like you, or is more one that you like the most?
The only thing, I love Shameless, and I never would have thought that I was a writer that fit the Shameless model, but I actually do, because it, you know, it's about working class people. It's tough and it's funny, and it's really, it has a lot of heart. And that is the kind of writing that I do. Even though it's a different kind of, you know, there are different characters than I had ever written about before, but they're also not. And that's what I found profound about working on a show like Shameless, you know, and working with some of the most amazing writers that could ever introduce me to television writing. And so, like, I just love the people with grit and with dirt under their nails and a lot of heart and soul, because those are the people that I think we underestimate. And I go really hard for the underdog.
So no matter the type of writing, those are your people.
Yeah, no matter the type. But I would say all of my writing has an element of humor. And I like to experience as much of the human emotional, you know, spectrum that is possible. I like to, you know, try to tap into as much of that as possible as an artist. It doesn't mean that everybody that sees my show is going to guarantee laugh, cry, and smile, you know, and think. But that's my goal, you know. And if I can hit it for at least a few people, then I know that I'm doing what I'm trying to, what I set out to do.
And you worked with Penn State School of Theater's MFA acting class of 2014 to create Blood at the Root, which was inspired by the case of the Gina Six in Gina, Louisiana, where six Black students were charged with attempted murder for a fight. And can you talk about what it was like to work on that project with Penn State students?
You know, it was a wonderful time to work on that project. At the time, you know, it was before 2013. It was right at the dawn of it. And so we hadn't really gotten into this new wave of political activism. So that play for those students at the time was their awakening into social justice, which they had no idea they were about to be at the forefront, at the vanguard of, you know. And it was a piece I wrote as a social justice piece to get those young people at the time who are now, you know, very viable working artists. One of them is actually in my musical, Ain't Too Proud. He's going to be having his Broadway debut on the show. But we started at Penn State, and I think that it was, at that time, revolutionary for that group of artists to start to build with each other and deal with their issues as a class of Black and white students, young men and women, and deal with gender and race in the way that they were doing in that show. It brought them together, but I think it just woke them all up to being sort of advocates for social change. I'm really proud of so many of them have gone on to do really incredible work coming out of that experience.
Are you able to share with us which student it is that will be in your musical?
So Christian Thompson will be playing Smokey Robinson and among many other characters in Ain't Too Proud.
On this topic, you contributed to a collection of plays called Black Lives, Black Words, which responded to the question, do Black lives matter today? And toward the end of your piece, which was called Giselle the Gazelle, mm-hmm. there was a line that stood out to me, and it says, and the screams were sirens, and the sirens were screams, and there was a police on foot, and he had a gun, and I couldn't breathe. I couldn't even breathe. And of course, I was struck by the final words of Eric Garner, who died after being put in a chokehold by a New York City Police Department officer. Mm-hmm. How much of what is happening in the world around you goes into your work?
Oh, all of it. I mean, I don't even know the purpose of creating art if not in response to the world around me. And so, and the art is there to help us find ways of communicating about what's happening in the world. So for me, when things are happening in the world that I can't even get my head around, I need a village to help me figure it out. That will also be what my work does, is to talk about it or to bring it up and not to solve it, to bring it up and make it a question that we can solve collectively in real life, and not in the art. And so everything, I think, you know, all of it, I think when we're seeing art is a revolution, you know. Toni K. Bambara, the writer, you know, she has a quote, the job of the writer is to make revolution irresistible. And that's how I see my role as an artist. You know, I want to put the issues out there. I want to show us a mirror, but I also want to get under our skin in a way that we haven't, you know, think about an issue in a way we haven't, so that it gets so deeply under our skin, we have to take action.
This is admittedly a little bit of a nebulous question, but as an artist, you're kind of creating something that's never existed before. You write words, and then you get to see people inhabit these words, and other people come and watch it and are impacted by it. Is that process as magical as it seems to be?
Oh, it very much is. I mean, that anyone would want to sit and that anyone would want to help bring someone else's story to life is really profound to me. And with theater in particular, it takes so many people to help bring a playwright's vision to life. You know, the actors, but also, you know, the behind the scenes, the set designers and the lighting designers and the stage managers and, you know, sound design. It takes so many people to help bring a vision together. It is true magic that that anyone would care that much about the work to bring it to life. But then to have other people sit in and experience it with you, it's like you create a world. I mean, it really is. It's feels superhuman to be able to do that.
And for our audience who wants to come and see some of your work, how can they do that?
Well, they can catch us in New York. Ain't Too Proud opens on Broadway in February of 2019. We start previews on February 28th. And they can also see my work is in print. I have my cycle of Detroit plays called The Detroit Project is in print at, you can look it up online. You can find it on Amazon. You can also find it at tdf.org. And, you know, I'm out there. So please look for my work. It comes, and if my work is in a city near you at your regional theaters, you can also find me that way.
And from what I understand, you were a child who was always writing and performing. What kind of things did you do even as a child that could help you see that this was the career path that you were on and to lead you to where you are now?
Well, I always talk about when I was a kid, I used to write, you know, like little short novellas. I had a Cabbage Patch doll, and I used to write these things called the Cabbage Patch Kid Mysteries. They did amazing things, like, you know, the Cabbage Patch Kids would go into communities and find kidnapped children. I would write this online paper and pass it around to my fellow third and fourth graders, and that was sort of my bug on, oh, people are really interested in the stories I have to tell. Let me do some more. But I used to write poetry, and my mother used to read to me a lot as a kid. Both my parents did, but my mom, she was a teacher, so she used to really love reading stories, and that was my bug, really, was her.
Dominique, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Playwright, performer, and poet Dominique Mariso is a Detroit native whose work often brings the voices and spirit of the city to the stage. Mariso has worked as a co-producer and story editor for the Showtime series Shameless. She was one of the 25 recipients of the 2018 MacArthur Fellowship, also known as the Genius Grant. She joined us on Skype. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take-note. I'm Shereen Stanford, WPSU.